Today's guest is Pauline, who, after working several years at a full-time job, decided that wasn't for her. So she left full-time employment with several hundred thousand dollars and a few rentals under her belt and started traveling the world and building up various side gigs and traveling full-time for years.
And now she's currently living on a lake in Guatemala in a very picturesque life. And we have a philosophical conversation with her about travel, about finding contentment, about was she and is she truly content in her current life right now? And I think all of us on this path to financial independence will find this discussion interesting. So with that, let's go.
Welcome to Fire Drill Podcast, where side hustles, savings, and creativity lead to financial independence. With your hosts, Gwen from Fiery Millennials and Jay from Millennial Boss.
Welcome to another episode of Fire Drill Podcast. Today's guest is Pauline. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And my awesome co-host, Jay. What up, Jay?
I'm here.
All right, so Pauline, give us a quick 90-second rundown on your life this far.
Okay, so I'm 37. I was born in Paris, France, and that's where I grew up until college. And when I graduated college, I went to business school and found out that the rat race thing was really not my thing. But I started thinking about how to get a better life with maximizing efforts for a short period of time. And I started working in my teen years. I had a lot of little side hustles in high school. So I've always made a lot of money compared to my friends when they used to have, say, $20 a week allowance. I was teaching piano to younger kids at my school during lunch for $20 an hour. So it was pretty easy to save from the start and also to realize how much effort it took to make money and how precious it would be to conserve it, because then you would be able to buy free time. I was never interested in stuff very much. I bought a few clothes with my first paychecks or CDs. But aside from that, what I wanted most was freedom. So after college, I went on a round the world trip for a year. And before I did that, I saved during my last year of college as much money as I could to finance my trip, but realized that I had about $25,000 in savings and I could actually buy a very small rental and go traveling with the rent money. So I got my first exposure to passive income. And since then, I've kept building all the while living abroad, traveling quite a bit. And now life finds me in Guatemala, where I run a little guest house in a small village in the jungle. I run a little education project and I have a couple more properties and life is pretty good.
Yeah, I see on Facebook all the time where you're looking for people to come and dog sit while you're away from Guatemala. And I really, really want to do it. But, timing hasn't worked out thus far. But if you ever need somebody to house sit or ever need a place to go, Pauline has a place in Guatemala that you can go dog sit.
Yes, please. I'm away about 4 or 5 months a
did
year.
Did you invite everyone over to her house?
I did.
Yeah. My house is pretty open. There's not even a key on it, so.
Well, you did post it in like one of the Facebook groups, right? I think you posted it in the Choose a Fi Facebook group or something.
Yeah, I actually have like 4 people from Choose a Fi come this year to dog sit, so that's pretty awesome. I thought it would be a good target group to have free time and travel hack their flights and come for a pretty much free holiday, so.
Definitely.
That worked out pretty well.
What kind of dog do you have? I think some people want to know what kind.
I have a super sweet Great Dane and a half because he just had a baby. So I have a 4-month-old Great Dane and 4-year-old Great Dane.
Oh my gosh. That's so cute. So cute.
Oh my gosh. They're so precious. I see photos and I'm just like, oh, look at that big guy.
Yes. Although my dog does not like the Great Dane across the street. Every time the Great Dane looks at him and he's like terrified. But he's huge too. So the two of them are just like staring at each
okay,
other.
But real talk, does Dallas really like any dog?
No, he doesn't. He doesn't like any dog, yeah. So, very true, very true.
Yeah, Napoleon gets barked at a lot for being so big in the village, and it doesn't get old. Like, every day we go on a walk, and every single day he gets barked at. So, but he doesn't react. They're super sweet.
Aw, that's good. I can't say the same for mine, but yeah. Okay, sorry. Back to, I just had to provide people to know what kind of dog they were dog sitting for. So you mentioned that you grew up in France, and it sounded like very early on, you kind of knew about the concept that you didn't always have to work forever. And for me, that didn't even enter my mind ever. So was this like culturally, the fact that you thought this, was this very different in France? Did you have some like mentors who influenced your thinking in this sense? I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that you discovered it so young.
I guess I just fell into it. My family is pretty thrifty and savvy, and there was always money for holidays, for example, or for higher education, but my dad would pretty much count the toilet paper sheets. So at the beginning, I thought that was pretty crazy and ridiculous since we were living a very nice middle-class life. And they encouraged me to start working really early. And my mom was working at my school, so she would find smaller kids that I could tutor after school or do a one-hour piano lesson with. So I was pushed towards entrepreneurship, and I was always that kid that says yes to people who need to move boxes or paint a wall or do whatever for them. And I think my great strength is when you start doing that in high school and you have a full course load and extracurricular activities, you get super resilient and you don't mind working an extra 10 hours. Whereas when you have a full-time job and kids and everything and you're trying to juggle life, it gets much harder. So I was lucky to have that. I was not taught about financial independence or how money would buy rather time or experiences, but I guess with the, you know, big holidays and otherwise frugal lifestyle, my parents kind of showed by example. But mostly it was when I started working at a cubicle. I was working for IBM for 2 years. They paid for my MBA. And I just thought, that's not my thing. And when I was starting to save for that world trip, started thinking, hey, you go out, you know, on Friday night and you spend $50 on beers and fun with friends, you could live on that for 3 days in Thailand. And then it started hitting me. You actually don't need a lot of money to live on. And since you're in a European country making a pretty good salary, you can actually save a little bit and a little bit and make it matter somewhere else. And then it turned into, actually, you might be able to retire before you're 40.
I know right now we're painting the picture in a very positive way, but your last job that you had before you chose this life, which you do consider yourself financially independent, so I do want to start that out, because we have a lot of guests on that are working towards financial independence, but we don't necessarily have that many that are. So you have hit that. So tell us about, before you left the working world, what your last job was like.
I was working in IT in the UK, and I had actually started a company with a friend in Barcelona a couple of years prior to that. We were doing energy-saving solutions like these little water filters that low-flow help you save money in the shower and stuff. And we were doing good. We were having contracts with like 20 hotels at a time, but suddenly we got the Spanish construction crisis and everything was down. People were not paying us. And I thought, okay, I just need a stable side stream of income. I want a rental, but I was not able to get a rental because I was self-employed. So I decided to move to the UK, get an IT job, get a paycheck for a couple of years until I was finally able to get a mortgage and get a rental property. And that last job was pretty terrible. I was miserable. There was a webcam on top of my head. I experienced racism for some reason for the first time. And, you know, all kinds of nasty comments because of my nationality. I just kept my mouth shut, just thought about the end goal. And once I got my property, I lived in there for about 6 months. And then I moved to Morocco. So the empty bedroom that I freed up actually provided enough rental income for me to rent anything pretty much anywhere in the world, because London is so expensive. And on top of that IT job, I had a few side gigs. I was tutoring French and Spanish at night, almost every night. I was waitressing at weddings on the weekends. I was writing for a few travel blogs, and the travel blog income started almost getting as high as my day job.
Can we pause just for 1 second here? Sorry, I want to go back to where you said the webcam. I can't believe that they were watching you on webcam. Can you explain this? Like, I don't understand. Did you have to consent to getting that installed, or they're looking at you through the laptop? What are you talking about?
You know, they were in the ceiling. And the reason that was given to us was that my boss was working from home, so he wanted to be able to make sure that everyone was sitting at their desk at the time. And apparently, I don't know if it's legal, we didn't sign anything, but they said, as long as we tell you there's a webcam, you know, it's not like a locker room with a webcam and you're unaware of it. So I didn't mind the webcam as much as a constant lack of trust. And I don't know, they were sending me all over Europe, for example, saying I would take a 5 a.m. flight and come back the next day at 11 a.m., but they would for sure give me extra days off to make up for that. And then when I would ask for an afternoon off, they would take it out of my holiday days. So, you know, not really the kind of people you want to work for. But I thought instead of starting employment again, I would have that track record of stable long-term contract, and that would really help me secure credit. So right after I got that apartment, I just cashed my Christmas check and gave my resignation.
So let's go down into this credit rabbit hole segue. So I recently ran across this myself. Now that I don't have W-2 employment, I have excellent credit. And I applied for an easy, quick 0% card, not anything super deluxe, you know. And I got the, we'll let you know in the 7 to 10 business days standard reply. And then I got denied. And I've never been denied for a credit card ever. And so I was like, oh, wow, this is not good. So
yeah, it sucks.
Yeah, I just basically have to stick with the credit cards that I have because I can't get more credit.
Yeah, I was aware of that before I left. So I made sure I got a couple of credit cards and progressively increased the balance limits. And I took advantage of a few 0% promotions at times to invest and buy land. For example, I would always repay in full by the end of the 0% interest period. But that was a great way to plan ahead and just get a bunch of cars, get the mortgage, get a line of credit, because once you're self-employed, it really gets hard to secure anything.
Absolutely. Yeah. And now that I'm selling my rental property, I will have to wait a very long time to get back into the rental property world, because it'll take me, either I have to buy in cash or it'll take me forever to build up enough creditworthiness again, if I stay self-employed, to be able to get a mortgage.
Or seller financing or something like that.
Partnership, yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah, private lenders or seller finance might be an option. I'm doing cash, so I bought 2 properties in Guatemala plus a few acres of land. I've done all that in cash. The first property I bought was actually going to be my main residence. So I was quite happy to pay cash because, you know, you don't have a mortgage or a bank on top of your head. And I considered it just an emotional decision to be safe in a paid-for house. So I didn't mind that. But now that I've turned it into a guest house and I've built the next house, it's a lot of cash that I have tied in. And my third house is going to be a cabin in Colorado. So that's going to be way more expensive. And I see all the building quotes and stuff.
Whoa.
And I think I'm looking at about $250,000 for that one.
Well, that's Whoa. Cheap for Colorado. So I want to know where, which, in a mountain town?
I'm about 45 minutes west of Denver. Do you know Central City and Black Hawk?
I do, because they have a casino there.
Yes, exactly. So they have super low property taxes for the people who live away from the casinos. So I bought 5 acres there, which was $75,000. And I'm thinking the house is going to be about 200.
So are you doing that for Airbnb?
Oh, no. I thought about it at the beginning. Thought, hey, that's going to be a cool new stream of income. Just going to Airbnb my Colorado rental when I'm not there. But just the cleaning part of it, I'm in the mountains. I'm a bit remote. So that would be the perfect getaway for people in Denver, you know, only 45 minutes. I'm in the middle of nowhere around National Forest. There's hiking. It's perfect. But if I have to pay someone $150 every time I want to rent the place. It's just not going to make sense. So I'm mostly banking on appreciation, because the other houses, the comparables, around upwards of 350, mostly 450 for the same kind of house. And I'm doing a log cabin, so they also get valued a little higher. I'm going for the tax-free exemption thing, hopefully. You know, if you live there 2 years and you declare that as your main residence, you can claim $250,000 tax-free.
So the plan is, you're building this home on the land, you're going to move there, you're going to live there for 2 years, and then you're going to try to sell it for a profit at some point after, within the last 5 years. Because you have to live there for 2 years out of five to get the tax-free exemption.
That's correct. Yeah. So that's the plan, but I really like the place, so I might end up keeping it. And I don't trust Colorado's going to boom forever, so I may have to weather crisis. But again, that's the advantage of paying cash. You can just sleep on your decision and wait 3 years. It's just not producing anything, but it's better than having the bank and not being able to sleep at night. But yeah, so far that's the plan. If I really, really like it, I might try to get a refinance and then move on with the cash, buy a rental next door or something like that.
So tell me what the process is like building a house in Guatemala versus Colorado.
Oh my God, Guatemala is so easy. I drew my own plans with a pen and paper, went to see a guy in my village, say, hey, can you do that for me? Oh, sure, let's start on Monday. And on Monday, I had 12 hard-working, super efficient guys moving like a little anthill back and forth with stones and shovels and everything. And in about 4 months, the house was a decent shell. Then I took a while because I went traveling and I like to be on top of them, just because language barriers, and sometimes they don't exactly understand what you say, but they'll pretend that they do for pride. And then you come back and you have, I don't know, 3 steps to go up to the toilet. So it was pretty easy. The only thing was I'm 1 hour away from town, so you really have to plan for your materials delivery, like pack up the truck so you just pay one delivery fee and little things like that. But globally, it went pretty smooth. Colorado is so far a big headache. I'm still drawing plans. Well, my plans have just been stamped by an engineer, so they're solid, but you have a ton of things you need to think about to be up to code. And then you forget the slightest thing, your work can be delayed for 2 or 3 weeks for the time for the inspector to come back. It's really a lot of rules. And I thought, you know, the land of the free, as long as your house would stand up, would let you build pretty much anything. And it turns out some things you don't even need or know about. For example, you need electricity outlets every 12 feet. And I have a super large room where I don't plan on plugging anything ever. So I put a couple in the corners, but I had to add the extra outlets. So it's not going to cost a lot of time and money to add that, but my plans would have been denied if I had not. And that's not the kind of thing you think about. You just think about four walls and a roof and want to go on with your builds. So it's been pretty hard. And the other problem is I have a really tight window on my 9,500 feet elevation. So it's going to snow mid-October at the best, and I don't want to build in the snow. But we're chugging along, and hopefully we'll get something by October, and if not, that's going to be for next spring.
So how can you do this from a citizenship perspective? You can buy in Guatemala, you can buy in the U.S. How can you do that?
Yeah, in the U.S., anyone can buy. Look at all the Chinese buyers, for example, on the West Coast, or all the Latinos in Miami investing in real estate. What I've done is I created a Wyoming LLC and I put the property there. It doesn't matter. I could have bought under my own name, but I was thinking from an Airbnb or rental perspective that I wanted to be dissociated from the liabilities. And yeah, it's pretty simple. The residency, you don't have to stay the whole year in your property. You can stay on a tourist visa. You can stay on a business visa. So it's really two completely separate things. But yeah, anyone can buy property pretty much anywhere. In Guatemala, the only restrictions, because I'm on a lake, is that you don't get a property title. You get a 30-year lease from the government to avoid, I don't know, a foreign country buying all the lands and locking them inland. You know, you buy all the beach and then they don't have access to the beach anymore because it's Bolivia now. So that's the only restriction they had. But again, foreigners are welcome to buy property and invest. They're pretty welcoming with investors.
How much is the lease per year and how much total was the investment in your two homes in Guatemala?
Right now, I have about $350,000 invested between the two homes. The first house was around $65,000, but I've put a good $100,000 in it. And the second house, the land was around $80,000 and it cost me same thing, about $80,000 to build it. And the lease is very inexpensive. It's about $200 or $300 a year. And then you pay property taxes, which are only $100,000. And that's about it.
Do you rent out one of the homes for profit?
Yes, one of them is a guest house. So I started out living in one of the rooms and renting out the other rooms. But I found out that because of my market, some of my rooms were not worth more than $20 a night. And when someone is coming for one or two nights, I need a housekeeper, which is $10. And then they use electricity and water, etc. They ruin the sheets, they break glasses and plates and every kind of things. Towels disappear. It was just not worth it. But mostly in terms of my time, I've come to a point where I value my time a lot. So writing 10 emails back and forth with people when you have a super nice template email with everything, the GPS, the Google Maps points, and then the day before they email you and they say, so where's the house again? We need the address. I just wanted to bang my head against the walls for $20. So what I did, I restructured my prices and I made a pretty nice offer for groups. So if you're 6 to 8 people, my house is about $20 a night per person, which is quite affordable. And so I get a lot of groups. It's 80% of my rentals. And for $150 a night, I will be much more accommodating in terms of how many emails I can tolerate from you.
That makes sense.
So, yeah, I have 2 bedrooms that are air conditioned and that I rent for $50 and $60 a night, respectively. So I still do a little bit of that, but mostly try to market heavily the entire house. And now, because I've had a lot of Guatemalan people, they live in the States, they come back for the summer, they want to bring grandma and the cousins, and they're 14 people. And at first, I just let them sleep on the floor and gave them extra mattresses. But I thought, hey, I got a second house now. So I just upped my price for more people. And if I'm not around, they can have both houses. But they cannot rent my residence if they don't rent the guest house. So it's just in order, again, to make it worth my time and effort. You can have the full guest house. And then if you need more accommodation, then you can have my extra house.
And this is Airbnb, right? Or VRBO?
I'm on Airbnb. I'm on HomeAway. I used to be on Booking.com, but they don't charge the client. So people didn't show up because, you know, they don't lose their deposit or anything. And 90% of the people would just turn around or find something on the way. I'm an 8-hour drive from Guatemala City. So you arrive, you're already hot and tired, and you see a bunch of hotels. You're like, oh, yeah, did we pay for that place? No, we didn't. Okay, so let's just sleep there. So I got really annoyed with Booking, and I didn't explore the other more hotel-like websites. So I was just really disappointed with the booking process. So, yeah, I stick to peer-to-peer, and HomeAway brings a little bit of people, but mostly Airbnb is the main source of income.
I'm looking at the pictures on your blog now, and your house is beautiful.
Thanks.
It's like exactly what you'd want it to be on a lake in Guatemala. I mean, amazing views. The inside-outside thing with the porch overlooking it, it's amazing.
Yeah, it's a pretty special place. I really like it down there.
Yeah, I don't blame you. So this is where your story, and it's confusing in an awesome way, but I'm a little confused on like how you made this all happen. Because I know from reading your story, I believe when you said you left your job, at that time, you'd only saved like $350,000 or something like that. And maybe you had a property. Did you say Morocco? Where did you have the property? Or was that Paris?
I had a 3-bedroom in a London suburb.
In London? Okay.
And I still had a little studio in Paris that was renting as well. So rental income free and clear was about $1,500 a month. And then I just had, investments, index funds and stuff like that. And I spent a couple of years in Morocco, not being fully financially independent yet, but I was living pretty cheap and I was keeping that travel blogging gig going. So I had an extra maybe $2,000 a month, which was more than enough to live and just keep compounding the rental income and the investment income. And it started snowballing at some point. But then I got tired of the travel blog. I was writing little articles like on TripAdvisor. Hey, that hotel has 20 rooms and it costs $50 a night. It was lucrative, but it was tedious. I thought that was the best job ever when I got it. Oh my God, I'm getting paid to travel. And then it kind of ruined travel to the point where I would have to stop my friends when we're sitting down at a restaurant and take pictures of all their plates before they can eat, or stop sightseeing and actually spend a full day in a busy street taking pictures of all the bars and all the menus and all the facades. I didn't like it. I thought it would ruin my passion for traveling. So I started thinking about other things I could do. I liked writing and I liked that internet/location independence gig. So I started my money blog, Rich Financial Independence, in 2012. And after about a year, the site was making $2,000 a month, pretty stable. So I started a second one about ways to make money and different side hustles that you can try, because people always ask me, but how do you make so much money? So I started that second site and I've bought 3 more. So I have 5 websites at the moment. And the past few years, they've made like $5,000 or $6,000 a month combined. So that again is not super passive in terms of income. And I could live off the fully passive income of rentals, and the guest house is pretty automated with my staff. But yeah, that just snowballed and compounded and ended up providing enough cash to buy properties and make other investments.
Didn't you do a land development project too?
I had 90 acres in Guatemala when I bought the guest house, but it was together with my ex, so we were business partners as well. And when we split, he kept the 90 acres and I kept the guest house. So yeah, we still have land for sale. If you want to come down and be my neighbor, you buy from him.
We're in the middle of a blogging mastermind right now where we're all trying to increase. Well, everyone has different goals. I mean, for me, I'm always very financially minded. So my goal is to increase my revenue on my blog. Gwen, I don't know if your goal is quite the same.
Yeah, it's not quite the same. I think my goal is just to have accountability for the blog and be more mindful in my posting schedule.
Yeah, we're on different edges of the sun with that. But to your point, Pauline, did you say that you bought the last 3 or did you build them?
No, I bought the last 3 websites.
Okay, where?
I just noticed that some friends stopped blogging and I send them an email and say, hey, interested in a sale?
Cool. Yeah, the reason I'm asking is because I got on the email list for Flippa.com, F-L-I-P-P-A, because I was trying to buy a domain name that was for sale through them. And you can literally buy on a market other people's blogs. And like one of the blogs was a beauty blog and people were making money like $5,000 a month through Amazon Associates or something like that. So if someone is interested in blogging, I mean, I guess like with my blog, the blog I'm talking about right now that I'm starting, it's for like my Etsy shop. So that's one of the reasons why I'm like primarily focused on revenue right now for that. But I could have technically bought someone else's blog that already had a bachelorette party blog and got a way big head start. So that could be an option for people. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, it's not a guarantee, especially if you buy a brand that had a face. And I don't know, you're buying Bobby's blog about DIY home improvements. And then Bobby's not around anymore and people miss Bobby. And it doesn't mean you're going to get the same amounts of traffic than he did or the same amount of revenue. So you have to be really careful about what kind of revenue the blog has. For example, affiliate income tends to stay pretty stable, whereas I bought a blog, for example, who wasn't making a lot of money, but after 3 months, I had made my money back because I have a lot of advertising contacts. It doesn't mean that the next person would make the same amount of money, or a different buyer would have made at the very same time. So yeah, it kind of eases up the process. You're buying design, you're buying some content, you're buying a little bit of traffic, but you would still have to put in a lot of hard work to make it viable.
Yeah, definitely.
As with anything online, there's always a catch.
Yeah, I mean, the hustle. There's no free lunch in this world. People are putting tons of time in to get to the point that they're making money. So
yeah, but take real estate, for example. Like, a blog is a piece of online real estate where your tenants never bother you and they always pay the rent because you're advertising contacts. You know, you're working with established brands and 99% of the time they pay you. Otherwise, you just remove their banners or end up the affiliate partnership and call it a day. And if you consider a blog making, I don't know, $500 a month, what kind of property would you have to buy in order to make that kind of money net after expenses? Probably $50,000 to $75,000 one. And you can buy a blog for under $5,000 that would make that kind of income. So it's a pretty good return. But again, yeah, you have to be willing to put in the work.
Yeah. And I guess I should say that lately, and especially with building this new Etsy shop blog, I realized I physically don't have to put in the work. At this point, I know what needs to be done, so I can just hire someone on Upwork for like $15 an hour, which I did, to build it for me. And then they send the work to me and I can be like, yep, that's what I wanted, or no, tweak this. And it's made the process much faster. So if someone is interested in like buying a blog for revenue, you could probably find other people. And on Upwork, you'll find other bloggers who are freelancers. So there's a lot of like the parenting type mommy blogs, I guess, that are popular. I found a lot of people that have those blogs, and I know that they know how to run a blog. They know how to do everything. So I feel in good hands outsourcing to them.
Yeah, especially if they're in the same niche. Like in finance, there are a lot of bloggers that offer VA services or web design, but they've worked with a ton of people in the finance niche, so you can be sure that they know about your particular requirements and not just about blogging.
Good point. Okay, so I won't talk about blogging anymore because I know like maybe there's some people who are interested and the other half are like, I want nothing to do with blogging. If you are interested, Gwen and I put together, it was a one pager, I guess it's now almost three pages, of everything about our blogs, like what we use for plugins and themes and the whole shebang. So if you're interested in starting a blog, this information will be helpful to you. If you go to the show notes for this episode at firedrillpodcast.com, you can put in your email address and you can download that blogging cheat sheet. Okay, so moving on from blogging. So Pauline, your life has kind of moved in so many different unexpected and kind of amazing ways. Do you have a guiding life philosophy?
Just have fun and do things I enjoy. So I guess it's been coming up in cycles where I would get super motivated about doing something and then the next way would open up sort of naturally. And I happen to like building, for example, which is lucrative if you do it well. And I enjoy creating something tangible compared to the websites where sometimes I feel like you don't really see the fruit of your labor. I mean, you have a few pages online, but I get a great sense of accomplishment when I see a house taking shape and I'm having fun. So that's what I'm doing right now. But 5 years ago, I wanted nothing to do with construction. I just wanted a nice place to live and happened to stumble into construction. So to answer your question, I don't really have a plan, but it's mostly, yeah, putting a high value on my free time, trying to automate as much as possible right now with the rentals, with the guests and the tourists, etc., etc., and doing things I like. So in the guest house, for example, I like to cook for the guests. I think it's fun. It's really not a good return on my investment because I have to go to the market, prepare the food, serve it, wait for them to eat, clean after them. So it's like a five-hour thing and I just charge $10 a person for dinner. But it's a nice moment. People appreciate it. I'm in the middle of the jungle, so I don't want to charge them $50 for dinner just because they're stuck in the middle of nowhere. It's kind of a public service. I charge high rates for the rental if you make it there. I try to give you services pretty much at cost. And that's a fun way to spend a few evenings a month. If I don't feel like it, I don't offer it to the guests and we're done. So I'm just trying to find things I enjoy doing, you know, dabbling in a different direction. And then sometimes a door opens and I just head that way.
So I think maybe many people listening, they may or may not be struggling to figure out how much they should have saved or how much income they should have coming in per month before they, quote unquote, go on the adventure and say that they're financially independent. With your particular journey, you were living in Europe in a high-ish cost of living place, mm-hmm. and then just decided like, well, and I don't know in your mind if you like thought that you had enough or what your plan was, but you kind of just like did it. Looking back, would you encourage people to not wait it out the whole time until they have a certain number or a certain passive income and just try to like let life take them where it takes them? Or do you advocate being a little bit more conservative and you wish you had been more conservative?
I'm pretty happy with the path I've taken because really my job was miserable and I could leave pretty well anywhere in the world, including I could have gone back to Paris with my, you know, 2000-ish passive income and have figured out, I don't know, a little job on the side to complement if I wanted to buy a little luxury here and there. So while it was not financial independence, I had that really nice cushion of savings and a monthly income stream that could let me live lean for as long as I needed. And then I just padded it up along the way. So my other option would have had been to suck it up for 5 more years and then retire in style. But that was just not a good fit for my personality. I was impatient. I was still cautious because, again, I was able to live on the amount I had, but I was not willing to delay freedom for the sake of a few thousands more in the bank. And I think a lot of people might reach that stage when, you know, it's enough to downgrade to a part-time job or have one parent stay home with the kids or something like that, or take 6 months off and then be able to wait for another job for another 6 months. And very often you don't see that because you have that big financial independence number at the end of the road. And you're like, oh my God, I need my million, my 5 millions, whatever. And when you sit down for a minute and actually consider your options, there are many different roads that you could take. And it could be, you know, use your savings to start a little side business. Again, blogging cost $100 to get started, or my first rental was $25,000. So, it doesn't take millions to get started with another little income stream that may not meet the 4% rule, but adding up and adding up, it's going to snowball and turn out pretty nice.
So we talked about a lot of the positive things about your current life, which sounds amazing. Is there anything, like, what are the downsides? What are the things that kind of keep you up at night with worries regarding your current lifestyle? Because it sounds pretty amazing.
Yeah, I sleep pretty well at night. I like the jungle and I like the adventure, but at one point I was a bit isolated in terms of social life, and I would put all my energy into local endeavors, like my build or my education project in the village, and I would go back to Europe for a month every year and call that my holiday. But really it was just rushing from family and friends and then going back on the plane again to be by myself for another year. So I've rectified that. And now, like last year, I went on 3 trips to Europe and a couple to the US. And I realized that it's not making a big dent in my budget because even if I fly over the ocean, I'm still going to stay for free with family or, you know, have a pretty low-key. We'll have a barbecue at home and not hit all the $100 bars. So I had to reorder kind of my priorities once saving was not a necessity, you still get in your frugal ways and you're like, oh no, but that trip, that's going to be another 5,000. Well, now it doesn't matter so much. So there was that. There was the isolation. I guess I've pretty much solved it. Sometimes I get the what am I doing lack of purpose when I had been blogging for a while and I got a little burned out. I was writing on 3 different websites, about 10 posts every week, and I was pushing myself. And I thought, hey, what's the point of doing that? But I didn't really have anything else to do. So I'm not the kind to lay in a hammock and sip a cocktail all day. And I guess that's one scary part about financial independence. People are like, what am I going to do with my days all day, every day? And then I flipped that again and imagined my perfect day, which was doing something meaningful, something that I enjoy, but also have time to read books and time to go on walks with my dog and time to exercise and time to prepare a really nice meal from scratch. And I guess I'm better at that rather than just keeping busy for the sake of it. I've become way more mindful about my time and energy. So yeah, right now I cannot think of too many struggles.
That's a great point. So you mentioned, you know, you're alone for the year, but at the same time, it sounded like you were making connections in the community. For anyone who's interested in maybe moving to kind of a different place, like Guatemala would be definitely different from where you grew up, for example. What recommendations do you have in order to like have those meaningful relationships or to try to build those to give you what you need relationship-wise?
Well, the thing in my village is most people went to school for a year or two and they're mostly working the land, they're raising chickens, and not really the kind of people I would sit down and have a really deep conversation. They're super nice. They're super genuine. And my village only had electricity 10 years ago, so no one grew up with a TV or a smartphone in their hands. And they have a lot of wisdom about the land, etc. But it's not the kind of conversations I'd have with my girlfriends in Paris or with my blogging friends online. So I just started making these connections. And a couple of years ago, I went purposefully. I went to the US for a month and my only goal was to meet someone different every day. So I went on hiking meetups. I went to blogger meetups. I went on dates. I visited old friends. I made new friends. And I was really pushing myself out of my comfort zone. I was, you know, comfy in the jungle, talking about raising chickens with my neighbors and saying hi to everyone, but that was about it. And suddenly I was sitting down for 2 hours with entrepreneurs and people who shared hobbies and interests. And I really realized that I was missing out on that. So that same year, I went to my first FinCon, the Financial Blogging Conference in San Diego. I went on a digital nomad cruise across the ocean with another 200 entrepreneurs, which was great because on top of sharing the entrepreneurial spirit that I would find at FinCon, they were also location independent. We were sharing a lot of the same problematics, you know, where do you spend Christmas? How often do you visit your family? Do you think living abroad is worth the isolation sometimes? Because travelers, or at least the digital nomads who spend a week here and there and then pack their bags and move to another city, they're often pretty lonely. It's hard to form relationships on the go. So in my village, I have the fact that I've been here for 6 years, so everyone knows me. I know a lot of people. It's a different kind of interaction, but it's still not entirely fulfilling for what I'm looking for. So now my plan is with the Colorado House to spend a few months in Colorado, a few months in Guatemala, get some hot, get some cold, get some exposure to different kinds of people, and then go back to Europe once or twice a year to visit my family. And I think I'm striking a pretty good balance with that. But when you move abroad, a country is never going to tick all the boxes. So sometimes the weather is going to be great, or the cost of living is going to be really low. It could be 18 time zones away. It could be in a place where you have dengue fever and all kinds of nasty tropical problems. It's never going to be perfect. So I'd suggest you go for a few months and you do a trial run and you see how you like it and how, whether you can live, I don't know, as a French person without wine and cheese, for example. Well, Guatemala has other delicacies and wonderful tropical fruits and pretty decent beer. So it works. It's never going to be perfect, but so is France. And I don't know if there's a perfect place.
The U.S. definitely is not perfect.
I like the U.S. because I find people, well, at least in Colorado and the places I've been, I find people to be pretty open. Like they would smile at you. They would say hi. They'd be pretty engaging. They may smoke talk easily. I like the ease of doing business. Things I don't like include the increasing government eye on you and, you know, with all the regulations. And I read somewhere that you need a permit to do so many jobs. Over half the jobs, you need some kind of government approval. If you want to cook food, you need a certain specification. If you want to be a builder, you need to be approved or registered. And I really like that in Guatemala, you just do anything. You don't ask for a permit. You just say sorry after the fact and then everything's done. So yeah, I'm looking at striking a balance again. It's all about balance.
Well, I think that's a great way to end the episode. We will ask you our final two. First, Pauline, if people want to follow your story and learn more about you, where can they find you?
I am at richfinancialindependence.com and you have all my Twitter and Facebook handles on the website.
Yep. And we will put that in our show notes. Gwen, do you want to ask the final question?
So given the fact that you've been all around the world and seen a lot of things and done a lot of experiences, I would be very interested to know what your wildest dream is.
That's a great question. Finding that balance and finding just a level of contentment and happiness that doesn't have to do with exterior factors, pretty much, just being able to enjoy the moments wherever. I love certain things about certain places, but after a while I start itching and just saying, okay, what's next? What am I going to do? Yeah, it's pretty simple. Just reach for contentment. It's not very wild.
You know, I actually might like that better than teleportation.
Yeah, it's like traveling is a bit like an all-you-can-eat buffet. After a while, you know, you go to Italy, you see the Vatican, but then you go to the rest of Europe and any small church is like, ah, I've seen the Vatican. And if you could find beauty and enjoyment anywhere in the smallest mountain and not having to climb a 14-hour every time you go on a hike, I think that's a pretty good place to be in life.
I think we would definitely agree. Yeah, Jay?
Yes, I love that. Well, thank you so much, Pauline. We really appreciate you coming on.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Go to our website, firedrillpodcast.com, to continue the discussion and get the link to our private Facebook group.
If you like us, leave us a review on iTunes. If you're like me, you have no idea how to do that. So in the podcast app or in iTunes, search for Fire Drill Podcast, find it, click the reviews tab, and write something to make my mother proud of me. We read every single review and want to say thank you from the bottom of our hearts for making this podcast possible.